Second Kings, chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, and 6 to 14. Let us listen for the word of the Lord. When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, the Lord has sent me to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, the Lord has sent me to the Jordan." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." So the two of them walked on. 50 men from the company of the prophets went and stood at a distance from the place where Elijah and Elisha had stopped at the Jordan. Elijah took his cloak, rolled it up, and struck the water with it. The water divided to the right and to the left, and the two of them crossed over on dry ground. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken from you?" "Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit," Elisha replied. "You have asked a difficult thing," Elijah said. "Yet if you see me when I am taken from you, it will be yours. Otherwise, it will not." As they were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them. And Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha saw this and cried out, my father, the chariots and the horsemen of Israel." And Elisha saw him no more. Then he took hold of his garment and tore it in two. Elisha then picked up Elijah's cloak that had fallen from him and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. He took the cloak that had fallen from Elijah and struck the water with it. "Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" he asked. When he struck the water, it divided to the right and to the left, and he crossed over. This is the word of the Lord.
Our New Testament text is from Luke chapter 9, verses 51 through 62. Let us listen for the word of the Lord. As the time drew near for Jesus to ascend to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. He sent messengers ahead to a Samaritan village to prepare for his arrival. But the people of the village did not welcome Jesus because he was on his way to Jerusalem. When James and John saw this, they said to Jesus, "Lord, should we call down fire from heaven to burn them up?" But Jesus turned and rebuked them. So they went on to another village. As they were walking along, someone said to Jesus, "I will follow you wherever you go." But Jesus replied, "Foxes have dens to live in, and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place even to lay his head." He said to another person, "Come, follow me." The man agreed, but he said, "Lord, first let me return home and bury my father." But Jesus told him, "Let the spiritually dead bury their own dead. Your duty is to go and preach the kingdom of God." Another said, "Yes, Lord, I will follow you, but first let me say goodbye to my family." But Jesus told him, "Anyone who puts his hand to the plow and then looks back is not fit for the kingdom of God." This is the word of the Lord. These two stories today, Elisha following Elijah, these disciples having a difficult time following Jesus, are both very much about what it means to follow. One of my favorite things to do is anything outside, in the wilderness especially, particularly climbing mountains. I love being up on top of a big mountain. And as mountains go, I have a favorite. Anybody been to Washington State? Not the district. There's a big mountain there. You know exactly which one when I say that, right? Mount Rainier. If you've been to Seattle and it's been a clear day, you've seen Mount Rainier. I mean, that happens three times a year, so you could be excused for missing it. But Mount Rainier is an incredible mountain, and one of the reasons I like it so much is that it is so much taller than anything else around it. It's actually, this is a weird quirk, there are 60-some 14,000-foot mountains in the lower 48 and none taller. I don't know why they're all in that narrow band, but in spite of the fact Mount Rainier is 14,450 feet tall, there is nothing any taller than 7,000 feet anywhere near it. So it looks just huge. It dwarfs the entire Cascade Range, and it's breathtaking. And I lived in Washington as a kid, had seen Mount Rainier. I moved back there. It was my first pastorate. It was in Kirkland, Washington, a suburb of Seattle. And every time I drove or flew in or out of Washington, every time I saw that mountain, I wanted nothing more than to be on top of it, right? I mean, have you thought that flying in when you're sitting right out your plane window and it's like, oh man, I want to be up there? Well, I had a group of guys in my church. They were older guys who had quite a bit of outdoor experience and mountaineering experience, and they offered to take me up the mountain, which is it's not just like, oh, let's go this afternoon. It's a full-on expedition. You have to climb up to, there's several different routes, but the route we took, Camp Sherman, and you spend the night, and then you start roping up and crossing these glaciers and crevasses, and then up some Ingram Flats, and it's quite a thing. You've got ice axes and crampons and harnesses, and you're roped together, it turns out when you rope up to a group of other people on a rope, you're all deeply connected. There's all sorts of wisdom and metaphors in that. It is actually called a joint death pact. if you're tied yourself to somebody else, your life is in their hands. They go, you go. And so these guys, very understandably, wanted to make sure I was safe to tie themselves to. So there's a bunch of mountaineering skills that they were training me for in the process. You have to be able to climb out of a crevasse if you fall in. They're called prussic knots that you have tied to your rope in front and back. And these little smaller knots, you can slide an inch your way up the rope. So they actually did this on the day in between where we were camped up there at Ingram Flats. They went and found a crevasse, and we started practicing. I mean, you put snow pickets in that you tie your rope off to. They drop a rope down the crevasse that just goes down into black. And they're like, Dan, over the side, let's go. What? Yeah. If we're tying onto you, we got to know you can get out of one of these things. All right. Over the side. There's trust, right? Trust is not, I believe the rope can hold me. Trust is going over the side. So I did, and it worked, and it got back up. But one of the most, and it was so great to have a group of people who knew what they were doing, who could help teach me and show me how to do this very complicated set of skills that isn't just putting one foot in front of another, it's getting up on top of a mountain, how to fall. We did the drills of how to fall on your ice axe and turn it into the slope so you could arrest a fall on a slide. We practiced all sorts of different skills that were involved in being able to get up there. And maybe one of the biggest metaphors for the whole thing was noticing that in climbing up, there's a whole mountain full of snow and ways you could go. But if I stepped out from behind Chuck, who is our expedition leader, and tried going on my own path, the same thing happened every time. It's called post-holing, where when you step on what looks like flat snow, you push all the way through, up to your thigh, with an 80-pound pack on your back, and it's no fun to get out. You pack down and crawl back out. But if you stay in the footsteps of the person you're following, you stay on top. And it is so much easier to climb the mountain following the person who knows where they're going, not kicking your own steps in. This first story of Elisha is a story of Elisha closely following Elijah. I love the story. And of course, we talked about this last week, right? That Elijah was off depressed by himself, and God said, no, I've got a bunch of other people. Go back and get with them. In fact, I've got somebody to help take over your work for you. And in the intervening chapters, we see Elijah investing his life in Elisha, being willing to share of his knowledge, his expertise, what he's doing. He's starting to teach Elisha the ropes, right? And this climactic story at the end is just such a neat, cool story. We get so much from this story. Crossing the Jordan, passing on the mantle, chariots of fire. All of these things are coming from this amazing story. And the day starts out, apparently Elisha knows, it says Elijah's time was about up, that he was going to be taken to heaven. And Elisha doesn't want him to go. And Elijah says, I'm going to go to Bethel and you stay here. And Elisha's like, no way, I am sticking with you. And they go up to Bethel, and then Elijah says, I've got to go back to the Jordan, or Jericho. Oh, you stay here. No, I am sticking with you. And he sticks with him down there. And then he says, I've got to go to the Jordan. I am sticking with you. This incredible, beautiful tenacity of loyalty and the willingness to stick with each other is such a core part of Scripture. I was listening to something on the book of Ruth. And if you haven't read it lately, oh man, I need to preach a series on that at some point. But Ruth's incredible willingness and tenacity to stick with Ruth is what makes that story beautiful. That it's somebody from a different tribe who's not obligated to stay connected and is willing to have this human connectedness. This is one of the more profound things Scripture puts forward as to our point here, is being one of being willing to tenaciously stick with each other. All of us, sticking with each of us through whatever we may be going through. And this is some of the beauty we see in the story of Elijah investing himself in Elisha and Elisha's willingness to stick by Elijah no matter what. And of course, Elijah says, what can I do for you? And this is just an incredible compliment, right? When Elisha says, I want your spirit, twice as much of it. The God that I see working through you, I want working through me even more. Elijah says, well, that's a big ask. I don't know if we can do that, but we'll try. If you see me taken up, you'll get it. If not, and then, man, there's just so many echoes in this passage. Elijah steps to the Jordan River, takes off his mantle, hits the river. Remind you of anything? Moses parting the Red Sea, right? This is some really incredible reminders of echoes of God being at work with his people, that God is still present with his people, that God is intimately present in this work of one generation passing on to the next, God's presence with us. Whose girl is that? Just kidding. Love you too, Gianna. You make all the noise you want. It's what it means to pass it on to the next generation, right? You got to put up with their noise sometimes. Elijah splits the water, walks through with his cloak, and then is taken up in chariots of fire, which, man, could we all sign up for that way out? Like, beautiful. He goes up into heaven, and Elisha is a little bit distraught, right? I mean, my father, like, It's a beautiful testimony that Elijah has become to him a father, someone who cares deeply about him, has invested himself in the next generation. What a powerful purpose and reminder for us that we are not just here for ourselves. We are here to pass on the wisdom, the knowledge, the experience, the love that we have. We are very much here to continue giving that to the people who come after us. Elijah is taken up into heaven in these chariots of fire, and Elisha's question is such a profound one. Where is the God of Elisha? What happens after that? He picks up Elijah's mantle. He strikes the Jordan River, and what happens? I mean, what do you think is going through Elisha's mind at that point? This is a big question, right? Where is the God of Elisha still here? If it's the God, is the God of Elijah, sorry, the God of Elisha? Or was this just a one-off? What an incredible experience to pick up that mantle, to hit the water and have it part. Where is the God of Elijah? With Elisha too, right? When we ask this question, where is the God of Elijah and Elisha? Same answer, right? With us too. This is exactly what Joel 2 points out when he says, in those days I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Where does God want to be pouring out this double portion of God's spirit? Your old men will dream dreams. Your young women will prophesy. Everybody! God is seeking to pour out God's spirit and presence in all of us. As Jesus heads for Jerusalem, this is a huge nod to Elijah here. As the time drew near for him to be taken up into heaven, does that remind you of anything? Elijah, chariots of fire. Of course, we don't actually see that in Jesus' literal life, right? Maybe there's some wisdom and maybe some hope and some joy in thinking about our deaths, however they may come, as being taken up into heaven, as our date with those chariots of fire. As the time drew near for Jesus to ascend to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem, a place where he knew he was going to face his own death, where he was going to be tortured and killed. But he goes anyway. They come to the Samaritan village, and of course the Samaritans don't think Jerusalem is where the temple is supposed to be. They think it's supposed to be in Shiloh, Bethel, where that Elijah story was happening. And so instead of welcoming Jesus in, they isolate themselves from him because he doesn't line up with their religion, with their politics. Oops. Jesus keeps going. And of course, by the way, at the time, rabbis were very well respected. Jesus was a rabbi, and the rabbis were kind of the modern equivalent of a political leader, rock star, actor, sports hero, right? I mean, this is the equivalent of LeBron James and George Clooney rolled into one. When parents had a baby and brought them home from, you know, the Jewish hospital that they had back then. what do you want your child to be when they grow up? Ooh, we want them to be a rabbi, a great rabbi. Rabbis were very well respected. They were the people everybody wanted their kids to grow up to be like. And the course was kind of difficult. You just couldn't be a rabbi because you wanted to. You spent, at about 7 or 8 years old, Jewish boys were put into synagogue school. And the first thing you did for the first couple years was memorize Torah. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. It was called Bet Sefer. And this first course of study, this was like elementary school for Jewish kids, was memorizing that. And that's all you did. You chanted it and learned it and memorized it. And then most people at the end of that ended up going back to their family trades, to being a fisherman or a carpenter or whatever it was. But if you were really good, then you went on to the next level, Bet Midrash. And in Bet Midrash, then you memorize the rest, the prophets. big chunk. Grant, Ryan, Abby, the rest of this summer, should we memorize this? No? Come on. Kids used to do it. How hard could it be? No, that's what they did. They memorized that. And then if you were really good, then you went on to Bet Talmud, and this was the place where you actually started learning interpretations and what the texts mean. And they say Rabbi Ben Hillel says this about the text, but no, Rabbi Ben Simeon says it means this, and they just start talking back and forth about that. And then after that, if you were really, really good, and almost everybody had washed out by this point and gone back home, you would go find a rabbi and ask if you could follow that rabbi. And if that rabbi said yes, well, the rabbi would ask you a bunch of questions. What do you think it means? What does this text mean? What's your take on this passage? What do you think it... And the rabbi would gauge your expertness, your capacity, your ability to be in, well, to become like the rabbi. The rabbi wanted students who were able to spread that rabbi's yoke, his teaching. And if a rabbi said, yes, come, follow me, it meant that the rabbi thought you had what it took to become like him. So Jesus says to these people, come, follow me. He's saying, I think you have what it takes. Of course, this is what we see him doing to Peter and James and John and Andrew, who are where? Fishing. Not being rabbis. They've washed out of rabbi school a long time ago. Jesus is calling the B team and turning the world upside down with people who got rejected, which is just a beautiful, incredible way God works in this world. But here we have, further on, Jesus calling people, and this is almost kind of a setup because this is at the end of his ministry, and the question is, what does it take to follow Jesus? What does it mean to be one of his disciples? And we have three people here who are following three different things that kind of get in the way. I mean, we have the Samaritans not accepting Jesus or welcoming in because he doesn't line up with their religion and their politics. And then we have someone who says they'll follow Jesus, but first Jesus warns him that his immediate temporal future may be a little bit less than ideal. You know, foxes have holes, birds have nests, but if you follow me, you may not know where you're sleeping tonight. We as humans love personal security and safety, right? If I'm choosing between having a warm bed to sleep in, or cool bed, as the case may be in the California summer, or not, I'm going to choose the option that has me sleeping in air conditioning, right? Yes, please. Every time. That's not new. But Jesus says following him might not be compatible with that. The next person says, Lord, let me bury my father first. By the way, this is kind of a euphemism. You got your inheritance after your father died. And so when somebody was saying, I need to bury my father before I do this, they're saying, I'm waiting around for my dad to die so I can get the money and then go. Now, with our lives and the decisions we make and what we point them towards, there is very few things as effective as pointing our lives towards getting more money, right? Because money gets you whatever else you need. There's not that many problems you can't solve by throwing money at them. What is Jesus saying when he says that path is spiritual death? Chasing money with your life is trading something beautiful for something very temporal. Then the next person says, I'll follow you, Lord, but hang on, I got to go back and say goodbye to my family first. Family is a beautiful thing. God created family as the core of how any of us even come into the world. But family can also be something that is more important to us than God. In fact, the experience of family back then was very much one of societal standing, tribe, identity. Who are you at your core often was determined by which tribe you came from and what your standing was in that tribe. And is that more important to you than following Jesus? These invitations that Jesus extends to follow him are, of course, beautiful, wonderful, broad. They are for you and I, as well as every single person who has ever lived, that we are each invited into something bigger and more transcendent beyond what we've been doing now. But Jesus is also clearly showing us that these things may result in one, some conflict with our politics or religion as we have practiced it up to this point. Two, that they may conflict with our personal security and safety. Following Jesus might get you into some uncomfortable situations. It might be trading temporal certainty and security for eternal security and safety. That's actually a pretty good deal, I think. There's been a lot of Christian leaders before me who've pointed out that is very much the path of Jesus, is exchanging temporal security for eternal security. When we're called to love the people around us, this could cost us some of our wealth. This could cost us some of our safety. It's still the best path. It could even conflict with tribe, with our identity, with the group of people we most associate ourselves with. That of course, as Jesus practiced, following the way of love means loving everyone. It means loving Samaritans. It means loving Sidonians. It means loving Moabites and Roman centurions. Everybody gets included, and the in-group sometimes doesn't like that. There was an expression back then, a blessing. Because if you went and found a rabbi, and the rabbi said, okay, you can follow me, the expression was, the blessing was, may you be covered in the dust of your rabbi. Which meant that may you be following your rabbi so closely that the dust that his sandals kicked up coated you. Because if you were following your rabbi that closely, you were going to become like your rabbi. Following Jesus closely is moving away from personal security and comfort as the source of our motivation and identity. Following Jesus is moving away from financial gain as the source of our motivation and identity. Following Jesus is moving away from even family, tribe, race, or nation as the primary source of motivation and identity. It is recognizing that all the humans are part of our family and all the kids are our kids. Following Jesus is this beautiful invitation into life on a different level, being concerned about things beyond just houses, money, and the farm. We are invited into a way of life that is different than that, a way of love and compassion and care, building a better world for every single human around us. This makes it difficult for us to sit idly by in comfort while others are suffering. Because if we love, we are called to do something to relieve that suffering. This is the incredible thing about following Jesus, right? Is that Jesus promised that he would be present with us. In fact, in Matthew 25, when Jesus says this is what it all comes down to, he says that what divides the sheep from the goats, that the only division is not the Christians and the non-Christians, it is those who cared for who fed the hungry, who clothed the naked, who cared for the sick, who visited the oppressed. And of course, the people who did that say, when? When did we ever see you, Lord? And he said, as much as you've done it to the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you've been doing it for me. The stunning implication of that is, where is Jesus present today? In all of us, right? In every single human, but maybe especially and most present at the bottom of the pile, at the humans who have it worst, at the people whose lives are the bleakest. Jesus says that is where our God is most present. And so for us to follow Jesus means going to those people and caring for them. That is what it means for us to be covered by the dust of our rabbi. Instead of following our own personal security, instead of following our own financial gain, instead of just sticking with our own tribe, it means being willing to step outside those things and follow Jesus to the lowest points, wherever we may find those people. One of the most profound experiences of my life was getting to take a mission trip to Kenya. We were out in the middle of Maasai land, about 20 miles from the nearest road, and we got to do some work out there, we built a building for a church, which I think was a stupid thing to do, but that's another thing. What was amazing about this and what was the profound experience for me is that one of the afternoons we got to go into one of these bomas, where it's the traditional way of life for the Maasai people, where they make two huge bramble fences. They cut down the thorn trees and pile them into about 12-foot tall, just thick fences to keep out the lions. They keep their cattle in the middle, which are the source of their life, and then their huts are in the ring in between. And they make their huts out of sticks and cow dung put together, and I mean, it's kind of a mud hut. And in one boma, the boma we went to, there was two men. Each one of them had, one had three wives, one had four wives, and there was probably about 40 kids. And they welcomed us into their boma, and you can imagine, if you're living in a hut made of sticks and cow dung, with the cattle in the center, the flies are thick. And there was this beautiful little baby in his mother's arms, and the flies were just thick on the baby's face. And they wouldn't even bother brushing him away because they'd just fly right back. Fliegen. But I looked at that little baby and had the incredible sense that I may have never been closer to Jesus in my entire life, sitting there in that mother's arms. We are each so much closer to Jesus than we realize every day. But most of the time, we just walk on and look away because we've got more important things to do. More than anything I carried back with me from that is remembering that every single person I meet, I am encountering Christ. And whatever I can do to bless them, to make their lives better, is precisely what I am doing here. It is precisely what it means to follow Jesus wherever he leads. This is why we ask for God's blessing for ourselves, right? Like Elisha says, I want a double portion of God's Spirit. Please bless me with that. This is what we mean when we say, God bless America. It is not saying, God, elevate America over and above these other countries around us. That's ugly and despicable. If we want God to bless us, it is so that we can be a blessing to the world around us. That was the American ideal. If America is founded on something that is good and pure and noble, it is our willingness to give of our resources, of our democracy, of our care, our comfort, our wealth to the world around us. If we aren't existing to be a blessing, asking God to bless us is the height of hypocrisy and evil. We want God to bless us. We want to remember that we should be a city on a hill, that everything we have is a good, wonderful thing, but the point of God blessing us is so that we can be a blessing to the rest of the world. The point of God blessing me personally is so that I can be a blessing to the people around me. This is how God works. This is what God said to Abraham, right? I will bless you that you may be a blessing to Christ in all of those places where he is found. In the least of these, in those who are most suffering, whatever their skin color, wherever they happen to be born, whatever their religion, they are each Christ incarnate. And our love for God is precisely as much as our love for the least of these, our brothers and sisters. Join me in singing our hymn of response. Lord, I want to be a Christian.